Welcome to episode 277 of After the Credits. I'm your host, Brain Antunes, joined today by special co-host
Melissa McDowell.
Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thanks. I love being an amateur podcaster with the professional.
Oh, please. You've been on the show before, though, haven't you?
Yes.
Okay.
Twice.
See? Yeah. Third time. We're going to make it more often than three times. But so I asked Melissa to join me today so we could talk about some favorite movies from the past year, I guess last year, 2019. Yeah, that's what we're here for.
Now, 10.
I call this like the favorite movies list because I feel uncomfortable calling it like a best of list because there is stuff on the list that I don't think is probably the best stuff from last year. But it's my favorite stuff from last year, and there's stuff that's like really good from 2019 that I probably never watch again, and I kind of don't feel like those are like my favorite movies of last year. So that's kind of how I generated my list. I've stopped like doing rules because rules are just
These lists are so subjective.
This is it.
What is the point of...
That's
you don't have
why.
To put stuff on because everybody else has
exactly.
it on their list.
And I've kind of gotten to the point now where I'm kind of like, you know, the list doesn't just have to be 10 because honestly, I liked more than 10 movies. And okay, so I did like 10 on a countdown list. But I mean, I think if you were to ask me tomorrow... The top three might not change, but everything else might be interchangeable. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how it's been since I've seen most of these movies. You kind of just get the gut feeling for it. You're either going to love it or not. It's just the way it is. I feel like saying the best movies of 2019 is so, like you say, the list feels so subjective that I don't feel comfortable saying those were the best movies of last year. Because otherwise there are movies that should be on the list that aren't, because I think that they're like technically they're better movies or they have something more to say that I think is important. But honestly, I'll probably never see them again. And they're movies that I might forget if you ask me again in 3 or 4 years. Whereas the movies that I give you today, I'm probably going to go, yeah, I'm going to remember those in 3 or 4 years because I'll probably rewatch them in 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 years.
Well, I think when you're talking about film lists, I mean, what moves people about movies? There's so many different things,
exactly.
Right? There's the aesthetic, there's the story, there's the acting. You know, like there's so much happening in that film, and you have people who are doing really technically innovative things. You have people that are telling stories that haven't been told before.
Yep.
All of those things, I feel like, factor into what makes a movie memorable or what makes it remarkable or what makes it something I would want to promote in a top 10 list.
Exactly.
And that's not necessarily... you know, the best of 2019, but
exactly.
It's my best of 2019.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's good enough.
I hope
you agree, listeners.
So how do you want to start? Do you want to start with like honorable mentions in like brackets or things that almost made the list, or do you want to leave those for last?
I'll tell you a little something about my very odd top 10.
Okay.
So when I sat down to start thinking about what I would consider my top 10 for the year, I realized that about like 6 of the 10 were female directors. And then I was like, well, this is dumb. Why don't I just do a whole top 10 list of female directed movies from 2019 that I think were really significant and deserve to be talked about? So that's what I did. So I don't have any male directed films on my list.
And
there were some pretty great male directed films in 2019 that I suppose I could put in as honorable mentions.
Okay, well, let's leave the honorable mentions for now. We'll come back to it post-list discussion. So what's your number 10?
So my number 10, and I'm probably going to mess up the pronunciation of the Cree, but it was Nipawistam Massawin, We Will Stand Up, the documentary by Tasha Hubbard on Colton Bushi.
Oh, yeah. Well, this was one of the VIFF titles, right?
Actually, no, it wasn't at VIFF. Oh. It played at the theater, but it wasn't in the festival itself.
Oh, okay.
It is. They're doing an upcoming screening at KDOCS, actually, in February. So if you have not seen it, you should totally go and see it because it's a really great movie. And it's also been playing on Air Canada has it on in-flight entertainment right now. So if you don't mind like sobbing
uncontrollably
among
like you know 100 and other people that. Are in the air with you.
Yeah. So I grew up in Saskatchewan. I'm a white settler lady. that grew up in Treaty 6 territory, so my perspective on the racism in Saskatchewan is obviously a pretty privileged one. But this film, I just thought, is a story that really needed to be told. I mean, what happened to Colton was such an injustice, and seeing how the justice system treated
killer. For like some of our listeners who are not Canadian or might not be familiar with the story, you might need to give us a little bit more about Colton Bushia and what happened. At least the very, very basic.
So the very basic story is that on a summer day, there was a truck full of Indigenous youth, like all in about their 20s, who pulled up on a farm into a farmyard because they had a flat tire, and they needed to repair the flat tire. There was the farmer and his son came out to confront these people. The farmer pulled a gun, shot Colton Bushy in the back of the head as he was trying to drive away from the property. And
then claimed it was self-defense, right?
Well, it actually, the defense was a bit more complicated than that. So essentially, yes, everybody talked about this as being like a self-defense strategy, that these kids were on his property trying to cause trouble, blah, blah, blah.
That's what I remember hearing.
But in fact, Canada doesn't have a stand your ground, defend your property law like the United States. So you can't actually use that as a defense in court. So what Gerald Stanley claimed was that it was a misfire. It was a hang fire in the gun. But a lot of gun experts will tell you that there's never been an incidence of a recorded hang fire that's lasted longer than like a fraction of a second. Mm-hmm. And this would have been a 30 to 60 second hang fire. So very unlikely. In any case, he was completely exonerated of this killing of a young, you know, guy in his 20s who was very promising. He was a firekeeper. He played a large role in his community. It really divided Saskatchewan. I think those divisions were always there, but I think that
it just brought them to light.
And I think Tasha did an amazing job of telling the story. And I think what's also really moving about the film is that Bushy's surviving family essentially went on a crusade to not just about, you know, the Stanley trial, but about the justice system in Canada and how it treats Indigenous people.
Yeah.
And the idea that, you know, when it comes to jury selection, like, our lawyers here don't have to give any reason why they dismiss someone from a jury. So interestingly, in the Stanley trial, every single visibly Indigenous person was dismissed from that jury, and they didn't have to justify it at all as to why that person should not be on the jury. So these were the kinds of things that the Bushy family was taking forward, that they were bringing forward.
And I think this is so important, because one of the things that, you know, people, outsiders, talk about, and it's like, oh, well, you know, Canada, or and even Canadians, like a lot of us will say, well, we don't have a racism problem. Well, actually, we have a really, really, really big racism problem. And I think one of the things that, you know, filmmakers, and I think it's become more of something that at least I've noticed over the last couple of years, we're getting more and more Indigenous voices telling their stories. And that's so important in shining a light on what is actually happening in this country.
Well, and I love, like, Tasha, there's a really great scene at the end of this film with Tasha and her grandfather and her son. And her grandfather is non-Indigenous, you know, and they start kind of talking about the Bushy trial, and the grandfather sort of has this, you know, well, you know, they were wrong on both sides, this was a defense of property kind of attitude. Mm-hmm. And Tasha and her son are both talking to him about sort of the injustice of what happened. And it's such a poignant moment, because we're so used to having conversations about racism with people who agree with us, or people who we have no relationship with.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so it doesn't matter. There's no stakes there, right? There's no skin in the game. If they disagree with you, whatever, you can write them off as a jerk. But this is her own family member.
Yeah.
And so I just thought it was incredibly brave of her to put that on screen. And I was just super, super moved by Tasha's telling of the story. And like, I just think Jade Tatusis, Colton's cousin, is just one of the most incredible women ever. If you listen to her UN speech and don't sob, you're probably not human. I just thought this was a really great piece of Canadian filmmaking and an important story and one that we all need to look at a little bit closer.
All right. Well, now I feel like I have not done my job, guys. So my number 10 is Trey Edward Schultz's Waves, which I absolutely loved. Now, I had skipped this. I say skipped in not so, like, that's not really the word, but I missed this when it played at VIFF, and I was really, really disappointed because I really, really like this filmmaker and I've liked his previous work. So I was really looking forward to it. I was really happy to finally catch up with it and be as impressed as everybody else was. I mean, it's amazing filmmaking. I love a good family drama, and you really don't get any better than this. You know, you have a brother and sister that are obviously having, you know, issues with their parents, but there's like way so much more going on with that. And I mean, the performances are amazing, the music is amazing, the cinematography is beautiful, and then the movie takes a total turn in like the third act. You think it's over, and then it takes a total shift, and you see the events and how they affected the family from this other perspective. And it's just really interesting filmmaking made by a white guy. Like, it's a story, it's a universal story. It's about family, but it's very much also about an African American family and how, you know, race does play into how you live your day-to-day life. Even, you know, they are privileged. They come from money, they have a good background, they go to a good school, they're well-respected in the community, but there is still the racism that's always playing in the background. I just thought it was stupendous filmmaking.
That's one of my 2019 films that I have not seen. It's on my like list of things that I've been kicking myself for not having seen yet.
I waited till too long, so yeah, I feel ya. But yeah, Waves was my number 10. You're in number 9.
So number 9 actually is another documentary. This one's on Netflix, so I feel like more people have probably seen it. It's American Factory.
Oh,
and this
yeah.
one, it was co-directed. It was a male-female director team. Yeah. he's the only man who made my list. but I just thought this was such a fascinating story about a Chinese company that reopens an auto glass factory in the United States and brings in a whole bunch of Chinese staff in supervisory roles over American factory workers, breaks the union, is paying people at way less wages than what they were making in the old GM plant that they used to work at. So I just think there's like so much stuff happening here, just in terms of that intersection of two cultures and where people are finding commonalities and where they're so far apart. And then also just this whole idea of the manufacturing industry and like where it's going. And I found this just so curious because, yeah. I mean, they shut down all these American auto plants to move them to cheaper jurisdictions where they would pay less for labor. So I was like really confused as to why a Chinese company would even open up a manufacturing company in the US.
Because I mean, you have to figure that there has to be some sort of monetary incentive, otherwise they wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
So I thought the same thing. One of the things that I found really interesting was just how my preconceptions of how I thought things were going to go with certain people, that they sort of are the character, like the central characters, like some of the folks that I thought for sure would be like, you know, like basically racist assholes, were turned out to be like the nicest people that were the most accommodating and most like they were more open to their relationship with these coworkers that they really had nothing in common with until you find out later that, you know, we're all human. We all have, you know, the same things. But I also thought it was really, really fascinating and really interesting filmmaking.
I was really blown away by the fact that Fuyao even gave them this kind of access.
Yeah, that too.
But yeah, and also this film was produced by the Obamas' new production company, which is also a little odd. I'm not sure what my expectations were from that.
Well, and if I'm not mistaken, though, I think they came in like after the fact, like after the
The film was already done.
Or like in post production kind of thing. Mm. I think it was like after one of the festival events or something that they came on board. But yeah, it's interesting that it's like the first film, and you can kind of maybe see sort of like the social issues that they're getting at with their production company. It'll be interesting to see what comes from them in the future. But
well, yeah, there's a few Democrat politicians that come off looking not too bad in this film, to be honest.
Exactly.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's a partisan film, but
no, but yeah, for sure.
But if you have certain sympathies, you won't be disappointed.
Exactly. That's a really good pick. My number 9 is also a documentary. on PBS, which is like 16 hours long, country music. Yes, I'm putting the Ken Burns film.
Yay!
In. He calls it a movie, so I'm going with it. I had PVR'd this thinking, okay, I'll watch this, you know, over a couple of days. I actually thought I'd watch it like as it aired, because I think it aired in one hour chunks. So there's, I think it's 8 episodes that are between an hour and a half each. And then I ended up starting it like long after it had aired. And then I couldn't stop watching. I just couldn't stop watching. It was like endlessly watchable. Because I found that it's not only a really fascinating look at country music, which is, for all intents and purposes, it is an American traditional song. Like, that's what it is. It's American traditional music. It's kind of what it started at. And it kind of gives you, he's a really great filmmaker. So, I mean, it's no surprise that it's about more than just country music. But in addition to being about, like, a really fascinating and really intense look at, you know, basically the early days of an entire genre of music into the modern times, it also gives you a really fascinating look at American history from a perspective that's not like immediately apparent. And I just found it like just completely fascinating and engaging and involving, and I'm obsessed. So yeah, it's great.
I
recommend it.
Ever since you started talking about that, I've really wanted to see it. I ended up listening to the Dolly Parton's America podcast.
Oh yeah, which is amazing.
I'm kind of obsessed with.
And it's amazing. Yeah. I mean, country music has certainly had like a moment in 2019. I mean, it's one of the largest genres of music in the United States and the world, really. So I mean, it's not too surprising, but it seems to, like, at least in the cultural speak of things, it seems to have made a bit of an impact this year. And, you know, I I've always liked Dolly Parton, so I couldn't be happier. I'm like happy as a pig and shit. So yeah, no, I really, really liked country music. I highly recommend it, even if you're not a fan of the genre itself. There's so much more that goes into it than just what you hear on, you know, top 40 country radio.
Well, the crossovers with pop music are quite something. My 5-year-old nephew will not stop singing Old Town Road. I tell you, he's obsessed.
So am I. Number 8.
Number 8, I chose Joanna Hogg's The Souvenir.
Oh, I love this movie so much.
It's so different from most of the things that are in the theater right now, because it's essentially autobiography on film. It's like Joanna Hogg is letting us into her diary, mm-hmm. and into her, not just her diary, but it's like almost like she went back to her diaries and now she's thinking about all the things that she learned from the experience with the reflection of 40 years, you know? And I just thought it was absolutely fascinating and heartbreaking and such an interesting look at what made her the artist that she is and what she took away from those time periods. Like, I thought, because during the film, she's in film school, and kind of all of these conversations that she's having, both with her partner and with like her instructors, are all like everything that she's talking about with film are all of the things that she's kind of showing us in the film that she's doing, like as you're watching it.
Yeah.
You know, so when she's talking about, you know, not just observing a character, but actually somehow conveying the interiority of the character, like you're like, oh yeah, you're doing that right now.
Yeah.
And you know, all of those things, I just thought it was such an interesting, it was almost like the magician letting you behind the curtain a little bit. So I found that like really fascinating, and I thought that Honor Swinton Byrne was phenomenal.
Yeah, she's
really
fantastic.
Great.
One of the things that I find really interesting about Joanna Hogg is, for me, this is kind of like she's been working towards this for like 3 movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I watched her 3 films back to back earlier in the year, kind of preparing for this when it was coming out in theaters, and then it never came. At least I missed it when it did. And I had seen them all. They were all on Criterion. So if you're interested, that's the place to see them. And I really liked her first film. And I found that I didn't care so much for the later films. But one of the things that I really appreciate about her work in general is how she deals with relationships. And that, like, she just lets things hang in a way that's really familiar, but also super uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can recognize when you've had those moments, but watching them from the outside, you're like, ooh, that's really uncomfortable and really awkward, and I can't believe I've had that conversation. And one of the things that I found here is the same thing. Like, the way that she handles the relationship is, like, from the outside, like, it feels like something so familiar, and, like, we've all had maybe not that particular conversation, but we've all had issues with partners and whatever else that kind of feel familiar and relatable in the way that she explains them. But you see them from the outside and you're like, how did you not see that that was problematic from the get-go? And you keep going back to it. Like, I think that you're right. Like, one of the things is the fact that she's kind of showing you behind the curtain. But what really works for me is just how emotional and how, like, real her characters and her relationships feel. And for me, that's what sort of keeps me coming back to some of her work, because I just find it like just really engaging and emotionally draining sometimes, but it's also cathartic. Like, you go through it and you come out at the other end and you're like, okay, I feel better because I feel like I've kind of exercised that demon from my body now. I'm okay for a little while.
Well, and so I feel like I should also mention that this was like a 99-cent rental on iTunes right now.
Do it,
so like,
people.
Yeah, it's worth way more than 99 cents.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So, yeah, just watch it. It's not a fast-paced film, but it is, I think, a rewarding one.
And I think, you know, in the scale of entertainment, like art versus entertainment, I think it's really engaging and really entertaining as well. Like, I think, you know, you're right, it's not a fast-paced movie, but it's a movie that's like, it gets you from the beginning, and I think it really keeps you interested.
Yeah.
And it's engaging.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I was watching it at home, and I didn't check my phone once during the runtime. I feel like that's a pretty good indicator.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah.
No, for sure. Yeah. For sure. Like, I had bet with Dan how long it was going to take us to watch The Irishman. So technically, we took a pee break and watched it over 2 days in two halves. So, you know, it wasn't so bad.
I did that one all in one sitting. But
yeah, I did it the first time in one sitting, so it was fine. My number eight is, I'm so ashamed. I feel like I need to apologize in advance.
Why?
Because I left this, like, until I would say the worst, like the last minute. Like, I should have made room for this like way in advance. I Lost My Body, Jeremy Kaplan's film. And as somebody that's kind of within the animation world, I kind of left it thinking that, okay, I'll get to it at some point. The log line.
And you screened it at your own festival.
I know. And the thing is, like, the log line was interesting, but so not what this movie's about. And so, like, I kept seeing the log line, and I'm like, okay, but that just sounds so not that interesting. Eventually, I did, you know, watch it and was like shocked. But that's the thing with this fucking log line. Ignore the log lines, people.
What was the log line?
It was like severed hand traverses along through Paris in search of body, of like his body. And technically, that's what the plot is, but the movie is way more involved with that. And what I was saying to somebody else, I think I explained it to Dan this way, is that the thing about, like, for me, animation is like the kind of thing where, because you can do anything with animation, I kind of feel like you can't just make an animated movie. Like, it doesn't replace live action. Like, I think that when you make an animated film, there's a reason why it should be animated. Like, there should be something that you're doing that you wouldn't be able to do live action. At least that's my personal feeling. And that's not always the case, but generally speaking, that's the case. And this movie, more than almost any movie I saw last year, was the film that I kind of went, okay, the medium suits the storytelling. Because, yes, that was the basic idea of the story. And if you'd seen a live action movie about a severed hand, you'd be like, gross. I don't want to watch.
Well, there was one. It was like a Vancouver filmmaker did it a couple of years ago, I think.
But yeah.
I don't think it went very
well. No,
far.
And it was different. Like, that was like for laughs. It was a little bit different, but it wasn't like, you know, you think gore factor and whatever else. But like, this is exactly the kind of thing that I would want to see animation used for, because, you know, he takes this basic concept and puts this hand in situations and in places where you see the story of this young man's life, basically, through these memories from this hand as it's making its way like across the city trying to find the body. But like, the way it's shot, like, it captures all of that emotion. I mean, it's stunning. It's like visually stunning. It's beautiful. It's really emotional. The music is amazing. Just like, the emotion is amazing. It's brilliant.
I loved the cinematography, yeah. the framing of yeah. this film.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the way that the shots are set up are is just so, like, I don't, do you still call it shots when it's animation?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The camera still moves through the shot, still moves through the action. You still have cinematography. Somebody needs to compose it.
Yeah. Right? Well, yeah, just the way that it was drawn, it's just, it's so dynamic. Like, I've never seen a 2D animation with that much dynamism in its shot roster and the and perspective, because so much of it is shot from the perspective of a hand on the ground.
Exactly.
And I was really blown away by the artistry of this film. I had an issue with part of the plot line, I think, was I don't want to be spoilery, but
it's on Netflix, so
watch it on Netflix, and you won't be upset about the artistry at all.
No, so that was my number 8. You're number 7.
Oh, my hero, Varda by Agnes.
Oh yes,
yeah. I'm just an enormous Agnes Varda fan, and I thought this was such an incredible gift for her to give us before she left, sort of her own little masterclass on her own filmmaking and what she felt was important in storytelling. And I just thought it was just a really nice way to spend, you know, an hour and a half in a dark theater with this icon, and have her do her own retrospective instead of leaving it to somebody else to screw up.
I agree.
I just thought it was, quite lovely.
I also thought that, you know, I'm not a huge fan. I mean, mostly because I haven't seen a lot of her film. And for that, I mean, part of it is my own, like, just blind spot. And part of it is a lot of it just doesn't, like, particularly appeal to me. Though having seen the documentary, I feel like I want to give it more of a go. But one of the things that I really thought was really, really interesting is, even as a non-fan, as just like a layman movie watcher, I was really impressed by the documentary. Like, it was it also makes for a really great introduction to a really great filmmaker mm-hmm. that had, you know, things to say. And I think that that's so important. And I thought it was a great introduction, even as, you know, as a great entry point for filmmakers and for students to kind of get away into, you know, one artist's point of view. I thought it was like a fantastic introduction. I wish there were more movies like that.
Yeah, I think what I respect most about Agnes is that she really didn't play by rules of genre at all. So all of her narrative features always feature real people that aren't actors, in roles that are based on themselves. Like, they're not, they weren't written until she met them.
No.
and, you know, and on all of her documentaries also feature these sort of weird little narrative fictional parts to them. So she really plays with genre and expectation a lot. And she also often puts herself in films, which I think is really an interesting thing. I think women are really reluctant to step into the spotlight and to take credit for their own creative work. And I think that she does that in spades.
And I think one of the things that I thought was interesting is that she did that from the beginning.
Yeah.
Like, she realized very early on that she was part of the storytelling, and she never stepped back from that, which I thought was really, really fascinating.
Yeah.
So good for her. Ahead of her time.
I love her.
My number 7 female filmmaker. I will toot my horn when I can. Little Joe, this movie has sat with me.
I haven't seen it yet.
This movie, it didn't scare me, but I don't even know exactly how I walked into this. It was because of Ben Whishaw is what it was. Because I kind of saw
amazing.
Him. Well, this is it. And he's not, as far as I'm concerned, he's not in enough movies. So whenever I see anything with him in it, I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to try to make the time for that. And then, you know, I looked at it, I'm like, oh, a horror movie with Ben Whishaw. Okay, I'm in. So much more than that. I don't even know. I mean, technically it's brilliant. The use of color is amazing. Best score of the year, hands down. So it's a combination of, I wrote it down, Teiji Iyo, he was a Japanese composer. And from my understanding is that they've taken a portion of one of his compositions and kind of edited it down to the movie. So it wasn't written specifically for the film. It was edited for the film by Marco Binder, who's also a composer. And I think that there was some new material that was also composed for the film. But the reason I mention it is because the score is just so, it sticks with you. Like, it's just so incongruous to the visuals that you're like, it just automatically stands out. But I mean, the performances are amazing. The movie is fantastic. And it has a lot to say, not just about us as social beings, but also what we're doing to the planet as far as biomedically changing fucking everything for no apparent reason or for reasons that we think are correct but maybe aren't. It's good. It's really, really good.
Yeah, I'm desperate to see this. I'm like, I'm waiting for it to open because, yeah, I missed it at VIFF because I couldn't make it work in my schedule and that made me very sad.
Yeah. So that's my number seven. What's your number six?
My number six is Jennifer Kent's The Nightingale.
Oh, it's much higher brutal. On my list.
It's brutal and amazing.
Yeah.
I just thought everything about this was really fascinating.
And Aileen Franciosi's performance is like...
She's incredible.
Stupendous.
She's incredible. And what is his name? Damon Harriman? He is always a jerk. Like, he's a jerk in everything. He played Manson twice.
Oh,
He played Punch and Punch and Judy. Like, every single thing he's in, he's a jerk.
A douche.
Yeah. He plays jerk really, really well, which makes me think he must be a fantastically wonderful human in real life.
Yeah, usually they are.
Yeah. And also Sam Claflin, I was like really surprised because he's so menacing and horrible, and you hate him so much in this film.
Yeah,
and that's so against type for him. And I thought that was pretty great. And just the commentary on colonialism and some of the intersectionality of oppression, I thought was really interesting.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I thought this was really well done. And I thought for me, it was a bit of a surprise because, I mean, I liked The Babadook, but I didn't think it was like, I wasn't on the this is the greatest horror movie ever made bandwagon. I thought it was interesting, but I didn't love it. But I was still curious because she was an interesting filmmaker. Like, there were interesting aspects to the storytelling of The Babadook that I liked. So when I saw Period Piece, I'm like, okay, I'm in. Yeah.
This is, though, I mean, I guess when it premiered at Cannes, there were lots of walkouts. In large part, I think because there is a rape sequence in this film.
Which is... very,
it's harrowing.
Yeah.
I do find it really interesting though when female filmmakers include rape scenes because I find that they tend to focus more on close-ups of the woman's face.
Yeah.
That it's less about the titillation of what's happening and it's more about,
I agree,
100%. What is happening in their face, what's happening in their mind while this is happening. I have a really hard time watching rape on film.
Me too.
But I think this was well done. It didn't make me want to walk out of the theater.
Yeah, and I generally, I'm with you, like I tend to avoid anything with any sort of sexual violence, particularly if it's directed by a man, I'm out. Mm-hmm. I generally won't even give it the time of day just because it's like rarely is it handled well.
No.
I feel that it's usually like used as some... Like, it's just unnecessary for whatever story they're telling. I find women, I think, for the same reason, handle it much, much differently. And usually the way that it plays into the stories that they're telling is different as well. Like, we see it. I think women just experience it in a different way. So I'm always a little more willing to give it a go. But, I mean, for me, I think what really struck me was just how emotionally powerful the story was. And I really like the sort of supernatural aspects that she infuses into the story as well, which I wasn't expecting, but which I think are really, really effective and which you don't often see in stories like this one. What really did it for me were the performances.
Yeah.
Josie is amazing.
Yeah.
And she really sells it.
Yeah. And Claire's journey through grief is so... Like, that is so well done, and it's so relatable.
Yeah.
Like, even if the circumstances of this film are so far outside of your own experience, everybody has been through some amount of grief,
and I think
you can relate to that
the stages.
That kind of journey that she goes on with grief, and then finally sort of resignation and acceptance, and I was really blown away by it. I thought it was great.
Me too. My number six. Okay, guys. Bill told me to watch this, and I kind of rolled my eyes very loudly. I went, well, okay, fine. So I popped it in, and oh my God, I saw this movie 3 times in the span of 3 days. So it's Diamantino.
Oh!
From Gabriel Abrantes and Daniel Schmidt. So the very basic idea is that there's this gentleman named Diamantino who is an amazing football player, football as in soccer. And there is a plan, a nefarious plan, to clone him, make an entire team of Diamantinos to bolster the Portuguese public, just as Portugal tries to exit the EU. This is the plan. They're going to make people happy and then get them to vote to leave the EU. It's ridiculous. It's hilarious. It's totally genius. Carlota Coda is brilliant. Just nothing short of brilliant. It's so, so, so ridiculous, but so funny. So, so funny. Totally endearing.
Is this one on Criterion Channel now?
It might be, yeah. Okay. It's one of the Kino Lorber movie titles, so yeah, it's probably on.
When it played at Cinematheque, I really wanted to see it, and I couldn't make any of the dates.
No, me either. Yeah. And I was so sad because Bill had been talking, because I think technically it's a title from 2018, that like the festival rounds in 2018 that kind of made it out theatrically in 2019. So good.
Also, the trailer is just brilliant. Like, just look up the trailer.
It's just so, so crazy. So, like, I watched it. I loved it. I made Dan watch it. He laughed so hard. And then, of course, there's very few movies that are in Portuguese that I can, like, legitimately share with my parents that I think they'll enjoy. Like, generally, mom might like something, but my dad won't really care for it. Everybody liked this one. Like, Dan saw it twice. I saw it 3 times. Like, my parents loved it. It's like the movie everybody can enjoy. It's just so much fun. I drank the Kool-Aid. Diamantino awesome. Was hilarious.
I gotta watch it.
It's pretty good. It's pretty fun. What's your number five?
My number five is High Life.
Oh, I don't know how I feel about this. I have very mixed feelings about this.
I really like Claire Denis. I think she makes really fascinating films. And I think the reason why this movie works so much for me is Juliette Binoche.
Yeah, who's fantastic.
I think she's brilliant in this. And I think her character is so complex and insane.
Mm-hmm.
And the plot of this film is so insane.
Yep.
But it's gorgeous. Like, it's filmed really well. The fuck box? Is that what they call it? The fuck box sequence where she's like masturbating in a room because they have a whole room set up just for masturbating. Was shockingly beautiful.
Yeah.
Like, I think she's really great at making something grotesque pretty. I don't know how she does it. But
no, I think go with that.
I think there's a lot of things in this film that are quite grotesque and somehow still strangely aesthetically pleasing, and I don't really understand how it works, but I just thought it was quite good. And I mean, our Pats is great, man.
I know. He's kind of amazing.
He's good in everything.
Yeah, pretty much. So there, Twilight haters. No. I feel like you do. I think that there's like the character is super complicated. I have zero interest in rewatching the movie to get anywhere deeper than my initial reaction of what the fuck am I watching. I couldn't get into it, like something about it. And I love space movies, especially space movies where like nothing really happens, but I don't know, I couldn't do it.
See, this is the thing. I thought there were a lot of sort of fascinating things happening here. For one, because this was kind of a commentary on the prison system.
Oh, totally.
And, you know, and prisoners' rights.
Yeah.
And so there was that. Juliette Binoche's character is like part mother, part mad scientist, part criminal. She's just all over the place. Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things that I think is really interesting, because it comes from a female filmmaker as well, is that she's a woman. Like, generally, it would be a man in that role. So the fact that you have Binoche playing this, like, super complicated, like, initially unreadable character is, like, fascinating. But I couldn't get into, like, any... I don't know. I just... it didn't really speak to me. I watched it, but kind of reluctantly. It just didn't work for me. I don't know what it is.
I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about this going into it.
I found it really cold, too.
Well, the reviews were so mixed.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I was hearing people who adored it and people who hated it. And some of the people that hated it, I was kind of surprised that they hated it. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't really sure how I was going to feel about this going in. And then I was like, as I was watching it, I was like, I really love this movie. I don't know what it says about me, but I really love this movie.
Nothing wrong with that. My number five, we talked about, it's The Nightingale, so that's fast.
Yay.
What's your number four?
My number four is, so this is the movie that I think you could watch with anybody. When I watched it, the first thing I thought was, I wish that I could have watched this film with my grandma. And it was The Farewell.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, like, this came out so early in the year, because I think, when did it come out? In the summer? It's been like 6 months, I think.
Yeah, since it feels that way.
But when I watched it, I felt like this would be my number one film of the year at the time. It was definitely my number one halfway through the year.
Yeah.
And I liked the story, and I loved, is it Zhao Shusen?
Yeah.
Who plays the grandmother?
Yes, yeah,
she's
amazing.
She is just incredible. Like, when you watch the end credits of the film, they show actual footage of Lulu Wang's real grandmother, and Zhao has, like, all of her mannerisms down perfectly.
Yeah.
It's kind of adorable. I think, like, I lost my grandmother, like, it's been 20 years now. And there's, like, a hug at the end of the film between Billy and her grandma. And I was like, I felt that hug so deeply.
It's a really, really, really intensely emotional film.
Yeah. There's so much, there's humor, but then there's so much pathos, and there's so much, you know, it's just such an interesting family film, you know. And then there are cultural elements as well. Like, when we watched it together. Yeah. Theater. And there were quite a lot of folks there who were of Chinese descent, and you could tell, like, they were taking things away from that movie, and they, like, there were things that were funny to them that I was absolutely not understanding as a dumb white girl watching this film.
Yeah, pretty much.
But I kind of love that. Like, I love that there's kind of more there. There's subtext there that I don't know. It's subtext to me. It's probably not subtext to other people who are watching it.
No. But it's interesting to know that there's another layer there, and that she didn't, like, dumb things down for the general audience. It just is what it is, and it works because it's a specific story that's also universal. And then there's more for, you know, people that have that knowledge.
Yeah, and I love okay that it's that. Like in both languages.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's really great. And then
there is only one language film. Bong Joon-ho says it all. Well, but it's true, right? I mean, I don't think, like, it just goes to show that there is more to filmmaking than just language. I mean, language is just one part of it. Like, the spoken language that people are saying is just one small part of it. There's so much more that goes unspoken. And a movie like The Farewell just goes to show that too, right?
Well, and having movies like The Farewell and Parasite be such huge mainstream hits is also...
It gives me hope,
it's
man.
Great, yeah.
Yeah. It gives me hope that, you know, maybe we are not just the, you know... destined for the Hollywood machine that only spits out the
same. Not everything
movie.
Has to be Disney.
Pretty much.
Disney.
Pretty much. But come on, man. Baby Yoda. My number four, speaking of which, Parasite is my number four. It had to make my list. I actually was surprised when I was doing my final list. I'm like, is it really number four? Should it be higher? It maybe should, but it's so good. It's just really great. It's a little bit of everything. But I mean, you know, if you're a fan of Bong Joon-ho, you've pretty much know what he's capable of doing, and so this comes as no surprise. It's just nice that everybody else is paying attention. Hi, welcome to the fan club. 10 years too late.
The only reason this didn't make my list is because Bong is male. And my list is entirely female.
Yep.
But this is one of my favorite watches of the year. I think it is such incredibly clever class commentary. And
super entertaining and really funny and really touching and just everything.
And incredibly unpredictable. Like, you start thinking you know it, like, where this is going, and then it completely knocks you on your butt.
Yeah.
And it's just fantastically well done. What's his name?
Oh,
Sung Kang Ho.
I'm not going to attempt
it. Who usually works with Bong in his films. Like, I think he's a fantastic actor. I mean, he's been great in everything. He's phenomenal here as the sort of patriarch of this poorer family. And just the like, Bong's films visually are so astonishing.
Yes.
Just all the parallels between, like, the poor family's house and the rich family's house and, like, what they're looking out of from their respective windows.
Yes.
And, like, all of those things. It's just so incredibly filmed, well done.
It's a masterclass in filmmaking.
Yep. Because, like, everything visual, is working.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, you could watch the movie 3 or 4 times, turn down the sound, and just watch the images, and you get something different or additional out of it. And all of his movies are like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's my number 4. Number 3
was Matty Diop's Atlantics.
Oh, yeah, which I really liked.
I love this film. Like, I really didn't know. I hadn't read a ton about it going in. I just knew that it took place in Senegal and that, you know, that it was a fresh young filmmaker. It's their first film, and it made a big splash in Cannes. And I just thought this was such an incredibly interesting love story. And there's also, again, undercurrents of class and refugees.
Yeah, immigration story. Like, there's so much going on here.
So, yeah, there's a lot happening in this film. And again, there was also a supernatural element in this that I thought was so well handled.
Agreed.
And, like, filmically, like, the way that she did it was so simple, but it's so incredibly effective when you're watching it. And I just was really into this movie. It's on Netflix, so you should watch it immediately.
Yeah, I was going to say Netflix. Yeah. my number 3, Little Women, because it's Little Women. Okay, so I'm far enough removed from, I guess, the 90s version of Little Women. I don't think I've seen it since the 90s, and I'm sure at some point I watched some part of one of the old versions. I have no idea. In the past, you've seen parts of Little Women one way or the other. I've really never read the book, so it's now on my to-read list, because I should probably fix that, because it's kind of shameful that I've never read it.
I feel like you'll be disappointed in the book after seeing Greta's movie, though.
Probably.
Yeah.
But I still think, like, for me, I won't feel like I've done my job until I've read Little Women, because at this point, it feels like, you know, I've turned 40 and I still haven't read it. Like, there's something wrong in the world. So, but Little Women, I love this movie, but then I always have to kind of precursor everything that's, like, sort of period, because I am such a period piece lover. Like, if it's a period movie, I'll probably watch it regardless of how good or bad it is. So for me, it was kind of like I was going to see it regardless. I was super impressed. I love the way that she balances the stories. I love the way that she balances the different plot lines, the different characters. And I mean, Joe is so lovely, but Florence Pugh, man. Florence Pugh is the best.
Well, and she made everybody actually like Amy. Amy has never been a super likable character in the story.
Well, and I mean, you can see why. I mean, she kind of comes across, I mean, there's some of the scenes, like, she comes across as a whiny baby.
Yeah.
And, like, she wants things that are so superficial. Like, in your mind, you're like, okay, she's so superficial. But then, you know, like, Greta Gerwig gives her an opportunity to kind of explain where she's coming from. You're kind of like, oh, well, yeah, that was so obvious. Why didn't I see that before? In the other 500 versions that have come before it, no one's ever looked at it in this way. But it's so clear that that's exactly what it was. I don't know. It's just, it's brilliant.
This is my number 2, actually. So I might as well just jump in. I think Greta's script is incredibly brilliant here. The way that she's basically torn this whole story apart and mashed it up and put different episodes beside each other. So it's not in chronological order. Still, at no point during the film was I ever confused about where we were, what time we were talking about.
No.
So it's done really intelligently. And in large part, that's because of the brilliance of the costume design and the makeup and the hair, because the hair is different in different time periods. It's really easy to figure out where you are. But just that juxtaposition of different thematic episodes, I think, was just so strong. Like, just so strong.
I think it changes, like, the not the themes, but I think it makes the themes
emphasis.
Of the, yeah. Mm-hmm. It changes it a little bit so that it's more obvious, to be totally honest.
Yeah, like, I'm not going to worry about spoilering of story that's been around for as long as Little Women has been around. So the bit at the end, sort of where she's cutting between a scene with Joe and her publisher talking about whether the heroine should end up married at the end of the story. and the scene where she's possibly chasing after Frederick at the train station. I just thought the juxtaposition of those two things was so, so, so brilliant, because it's reached the point in the story with Frederick where you want her to chase after him. You want her to end up with him. And then she throws this bit in with the publisher and it's like, well, hey, wait a minute. Why is it so important to you that the heroine ends up coupled off in the end? Like, isn't she formidable enough on her own? And I love that Greta Gerwig does that. I love that she makes us ask that question, that she like reins that in for us and really makes us kind of look at ourselves and go, why do I care so much that she ends up with this guy? Like, she's great either way. She would be totally fine if she was single.
Totally. Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's a period piece that has like complete modern int. And it's really, really well made. And it's a lot of fun to watch.
Brilliant, just brilliant performances again. Like, all of those people are amazing. Like, Florence is incredible. Great.
Can we say Florence is not a breakthrough performance? Like, the girl's been around for a while. She's been making good stuff for a while. If you haven't seen her before, just open up IMDb, check a credit listing. You can't go wrong with any of it.
No, I agree. Yeah, she's incredible. But like, Greta Gerwig, I think she, like, if she is not nominated for Best Director at the Academy Awards, she's being absolutely robbed. Agreed. If she's not nominated for Best Screenplay at the Academy Awards, she's absolutely being robbed. Because I think that the way that she reorganized the story is absolutely brilliant. It's one of the best adaptations probably that's ever been written. And so I think she deserves some recognition for that.
I'm in. My number two is Uncut Gems.
I haven't seen it yet.
So this movie kicked my ass. I really liked Good Time. I liked the Safdies. I did not like their first film, but Good Time sort of sold me on their brilliance, and this movie does not disappoint. It really is Adam Sandler at his best, and this movie is really, like, I've heard people say it's so unlikable. Like, I don't know how you could watch this movie and like this movie. But the thing is, like, yeah, he's an unlikable character, but it's a really, really, for me, it's a super entertaining story. Like, it's, you have this guy that's just like lost and completely in a downward spiral, and he doesn't see it, and he's always optimistic, and he's always thinking the next one is going to be the big one, and it's going to work out, and it's all, in the end, it's all going to be great. And you kind of go with it, and you're like, well, he can't be wrong. And then things keep happening, and you're like, well, you know, he can't be wrong. Well, maybe the world is out against them. I don't know. But I mean, it's brilliant filmmaking. It really is. It has like a kinetic energy. It's always on the move. Like, the character's always doing something. The camera's always moving. Like, there's always something happening on screen. And I still am, like, I can't wait to see like the behind the scenes making of this thing, because more than almost any other movie I saw this year, like, just the way the camera and like the blocking and everything is working, because like, the characters are in almost every scene, there's people talking over each other and there's stuff happening in the background, and you're like, well, where am I supposed to look? Like, what's important here? There's always so much going on screen, but there's like just an energy to it. And that's what I like. I left, like, it ended and I'm like, okay, I'm exhausted. Can we watch that again? Like, it feels like you've run a marathon by the time it's over, because there's just so much happening. And I don't know. I mean, I don't need to like a character in order to like go into a movie. Like, I just need to have some sort of in. And there's just, for me, Sandler kind of gives this really like unlikable guy a kind of like lovable, like, bad guy. Like, he's like, so much bad shit happens to him that you can't help but feel like, okay, he's got to get, like, something good has to happen to this guy at some point. Like, that's the feeling. It's like, you keep watching because you're like, okay, the next one, something good is going to happen at some point. But, you know, it's real life, so.
I'm just, like, amazed that I'm excited and really badly want to see an Adam Sandler movie. Because usually an Adam Sandler movie drops on Netflix and my eyes roll so far back into the back of my head that I, you know, can't see for 3 days.
So I highly, highly, highly recommend. Around this time of year, I love a lot of the Actors on Actors things, the roundtables and stuff that they do. There was one with Brad Pitt and Adam Sandler. It's one of the, I think it's Variety Actors on Actors. I'll dig it up. I'll put it in the show notes. It's fascinating because these guys are about the same age. They kind of started at about the same time. And Pitt, you know, talks to, you know, Sandler about, you know, Netflix and streaming and like getting there basically first before anybody else. And it's fascinating to hear him talk about kind of his thinking when he went into it. And I mean, truth be told, I mean, when Adam Sandler's making movies, a lot of times he's making movies that, you know, are just for him and his friends. Like, it's him giving his friends work and making really stupid comedies that sometimes hit. But I mean,
Well, they haven't hit for a long time.
No, and that's the thing. Yeah. Like, every once in a while they did hit, but it's been, like you say, a long time since they have. But I think that given the right, and obviously given the right material, he can act. Mm-hmm. Like, he's made good movies.
Oh, yeah. Like, Punch Drunk Love was obviously an example.
Yeah.
What was it? Funny People? Yeah, the one that he did with Seth Rogen.
Yeah. Really, so, I mean, he's a good actor. Given the right material and the opportunity, and this was definitely the right material and the opportunity, I recommend it, but probably not for everybody. I fully am aware that it's not a movie for everybody, and apparently I saw a headline the other day that it's like the movie with the most swear words in history or something as far as running time is concerned.
Oh,
there's a lot of swearing. I don't know.
No problems with that.
No, me either.
No fucking problems with that.
What is your number one?
My number one is, okay, I think this woman is one of the greatest filmmakers of our time. Woman from France by the name of Céline Sciamma.
Yep.
So the film this year is Portrait of a Lady on Fire. It is a gloriously filmed love story. About a love that cannot be.
No.
I personally found some parallels with Call Me By Your Name, not just because of the LGBT context but also just because of, you know, I think these two stories are the best told stories about love lost.
Fleeting love.
Yeah.
Like you say, love that cannot be, for whatever reason.
Yeah, for whatever reason. I think Adèle Haenel is incredible. She's just so watchable on screen. Like, you just can't take your eyes off of her on screen. And the way that Sciamma films her, it's like you are falling in love with her through the eye of the camera as the young artist is falling in love with her.
Yeah.
And then I found out afterwards that they were dating, that Sciamma and Haenel were dating.
Oh, okay.
So then it kind of made a little bit more sense. But I also just think that Céline Sciamma is just an incredible filmmaker, mostly because she's writing her own scripts. Like, these are all her own stories. You know, so she came out with Tomboy, she came out with Girlhood, she came out with, she also wrote the treatment for My Life as a Courgette. And this film, I just think, oh, there was another one. I think it was Being 17. Was another film that came out at VIFF a couple of years ago. But I just think she's an incredible screenwriter. She just writes such beautifully human stories. They're so relatable. And then this film was just absolutely stunning visually. I thought it was just absolutely stunning. It's so moving. There's a whole subplot in here about unwanted pregnancy and abortion, mm-hmm. which I thought was just made, you know, a film that takes place in the 18th century makes it a lot more relatable to today's world.
I guess. I really like the way that storyline is handled.
Yeah.
Too. It's just very matter of fact, but there's just something very touching about it. I just love that it's all women. Mm-hmm. It's just women everywhere, and it's lovely. We don't need men. That's essentially what it comes down to. I say this before I reveal my number one, which is like the manliest of man movies. I apologize in advance, but I really, really like this movie too. And I have been totally creeping her Instagram. Sciamma's Instagram is legit the best.
Oh, I'm not even following her on Instagram.
Just
a bad fan now.
The Golden Globes behind the scenes has been spectacular.
I think she's a genius, saying. And she's like the same age as me, and it makes me feel like I'm so unaccomplished.
I know. I just refuse to look at it. I'm like, just don't look at it. It'll be fine. You're doing just fine in your own life.
Yeah.
It's okay. But I haven't seen any of her other films. And the funny thing is, like, they're on my watch list, and they have been for years. So I'm going to rectify that.
She's a genius. Like, again, here's another one. Go through her IMDb and just watch everything.
Anything. Yeah.
Everything she's ever been associated with
is great.
Genius, because she is a phenomenal writer. Yeah.
I really like this movie quite a bit. I loved it. And it made me cry. The ending made me cry. Legit. Okay, so my number one movie. I cried more than once. but it is like the manliest of man movies. Ad Astra, I say as I breathe through my nose. Okay, so James Gray, yes, okay, we all know James Gray makes man movies, but there's something about his man movies that really work for me. I don't know what it is. I love space movies that are about more than just space, and there's just something really touching for me about the story about a man, like, that ends up having to, like, search for his father, who he thinks he's lost. And that story rings true in some ways. But I just love the way this movie is shot. It's beautiful. Brad Pitt is amazing. He really should win an Oscar for this performance. Most likely he's going to win an Oscar for his Tarantino performance. But I mean, he's deserving either way. But he just emotes really, really well. And James Gray can be very cold sometimes. I find that his movies are sometimes kind of like, when you read them, they can be kind of distant. But I've found my own way into them. And generally speaking, I've really enjoyed his films over the years. And there's just something about, and like I say, there he's like the manliest of men. Because all of his movies are about men doing very manly things. But, I mean, in this movie, there literally is, like, one woman.
Ruth Negga.
Ruth Negga's in it. I
mean, she's pretty great. And then Liv Tyler shows up a couple of times.
But, I mean, Ruth Negga's barely in it. Like, yeah. They share a really intense moment. But it's really a movie about a guy searching for his father through space. But I really could relate to that story. And I found it, like, just really emotionally fulfilling and visually stunning. I never thought I would say to Dan, we got to watch this movie. There's an amazing moon space battle on buggies. And Dan's like, what? I'm like, just watch it. It's amazing. And like on second and third viewing, it still looks amazing. It's the only movie I've bought on Blu-ray this year.
It's true. The art direction, the production design, and the cinematography in this film
are just working.
Stunning, stunning, stunning.
And
how do you say his name? Hoyt van Hoytema?
Hoyten?
I have no idea. Anyway, dude knows how to point a camera and light things.
No shit, right? Yeah, he does an okay job of that.
The lighting is great. That sequence where they're in the big chase on
the moon,
on Mars, is really incredible.
It's super impressive. Yeah. But I mean, for me, I found the film that has like a really powerful emotional core. And for me, it works because of Brad Pitt. And the interaction he has with Tommy Lee Jones, that conversation, I found it really, really touching.
Like, I kind of have to go with Quentin Tarantino with his criticism of the actual plot point. Like, I agree with you that the emotional journey and whole like father son stuff is all like, it's great payoff.
But
the whole like, why are these pulses happening makes absolutely no sense.
No, of course not. I'm happy to.
But I think you can watch the film with and suppress that because it's not the central focus.
No, for me, it's certainly not. I saw that movie and I'm like, yeah, this is it. This is the one. I'm married to this one.
It is really beautiful. And yeah, Pitt does a great job.
Yeah, that was my number one.
Well, there we go.
There's
our top tens.
Yeah.
Tons of overlap.
No. And lots of good stuff to watch. Okay, so what do you have? I see some like little honorable mentions at the bottom there. What do you got there?
Oh, so these were other female directed films that actually didn't make the top 10, but were honorable mentions.
Bring it on.
Olivia Wilde's Booksmart.
Yeah.
It's a very funny coming of age film. Because We Are Girls, which was an NFB project documentary about the Cooney sisters who
heartbreaking.
It was, yeah. So it's a film about childhood sexual abuse. So you should know that going in. It is heavy subject matter. But I think you will be absolutely moved and blown away by the strength of these sisters and their fight to get justice.
Mm-hmm.
Not just through the justice system, but also in their own families. And there's a very moving confrontation scene between the girls and their parents that is just heart-wrenching to watch. And
that camera holds on that confrontation for just long enough that it makes you squirm.
Yeah.
It's really hard to watch, but really, really, really powerful.
But yeah, I think it's really important. And I've seen a number of Q&As with the Pooney sisters. Yeah. They're all just such incredible women. I have so much respect for them. And I think that by allowing their story to be told this way, I think it really is going to make a difference for a lot of people.
Yes.
This sold out so heavily at Doxa that they had to add extra screenings.
And it's done. They've done a lot of community screenings. I went to one of the community screenings mm-hmm. and was really impressed by the film and by the sisters that did a Q&A afterwards too. It's really moving.
Yeah. And then even on a technical level, I found the cinematography in this film was brilliant. Yes. There's some really great like overhead drone shots and just some really nice camera work.
Yeah,
in
really
this film.
Well used. Yeah, I agree.
And I'm also biased because a friend of mine was the associate producer on this.
Doesn't
film.
Matter.
Shout outs to Terry Snellgrove.
Yeah.
And then some other honorable mentions, Antigone, which was Canada's submission to the Academy Awards foreign film yep. nomination. I thought this was a really interesting update of the story. Not all of it worked for me, but I was really kind of blown away by this filmmaker whose name is gone out of my head right now.
Sophie something or other.
Sophie
Desplechin. I might be wrong.
Dispatch. Anyway, she wrote, directed, edited, filmed
yep.
this film. She did everything yep. on this movie. And it is really very well made. So I thought that was fantastic. And I also thought that the lead actress was incredible. She acted the heck out of this
so
movie.
It's Sophie Deraspe.
Ah, okay.
I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong.
Deraspe, I think.
Yeah.
Sophie Deraspe.
All I can say is she's super, super lovely. I got to sit next to her at the Whistler Film Festival where she swept the Borsos prizes, like best actress for, I think her name is Nina. Is it Nina? Nahima Ricci, who won like best actress, and then
she deserved
another,
it. She
and then
great.
Another film won, and then it was like a sweep for Antigone. And I like, she's a really well respected filmmaker. She's made a number of films. She's won lots of prizes over the years. She's super accomplished. The most down to earth person I've ever met in my life. She was super, super sweet. And the movie, I agree, I think is really fantastic. It's a really great update.
I just like, it's like, this was like a one woman production and she knocked this thing out of the park.
Yeah,
like, I thought it was really well done. I think it touched on some issues around refugees and around citizenship and around the deportation of people who commit crimes within our country. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure it went far enough with some of those issues. I think I would have liked to have seen it go a little bit further politically. But the film itself is really compelling and really watchable and really interesting. And I'm just so blown away by someone who could take on all of those roles and still make a coherent film.
Agreed.
And then my other honorable mention for my women-led films this year is another local production, The Body Remembers When the World Broke Open,
which is
Kathleen Hepburn and El Maya Tailfeathers.
Yeah.
This film is just, I'm in love with the production story here, in large part because they did all of this cultural sensitivity training on set. They mentored a whole bunch of indigenous youth into below-the-line production roles and filmmaking roles. They filmed all of this to look like it was unrolling in real time. So it basically looks like it's a continual shot through the whole film. So I think all of those things are just so like fascinating. The process of this film is just so fascinating to me. And I just think El Maya Tailfeathers is so compelling to watch on screen. Like, she's another person that it's really hard to take your eyes off her when she's on screen.
I agree.
And the young actress that they hired, who had no previous acting experience
who's
to play
really
the other
fantastic.
Role, is phenomenal in this. Like, when I found out she had never acted before in her life, like, she went
shocking.
To an open casting call and never acted in her life, and she's really brilliant in this movie. It's totally worth watching. I'm also super impressed that Ava DuVernay's production company has picked this up for distribution. So this is a Canadian film that's going to get way bigger distribution and way more attention than many small Canadian independent films because DuVernay's company is going to get behind it. So I think that is awesome.
And it's a really well told, I mean, it's really well made and a really fascinating story that's really timely and really important. Deals with a lot of different subject matters, which I think was really, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was quite good.
Yeah. I mean, it highlights, there's a lot of things that this film is sort of dealing with. It's, you know, relationships between women and, you know, a lack of opportunities for women who are trying to flee violence, how difficult that can be for people. There's issues also around race and indigeneity. And it's just, there's a lot of stuff happening in this film. And I think the people who are involved in making it should be very, very proud of themselves, because I think they did a great job. And I'm glad that it's going to get the distribution that it needs to.
I agree. I want to throw into the mix Immortal, which is a little Russian film. It's hardly a movie. It's like just over 60 minutes long, but it's a documentary about this little place in the middle of nowhere, Russia. And it's a documentary. There's actually no interviews. It's all like just reference video of these things happening in this place. And it's just a fascinating snapshot, not just of a really interesting place that seems to be stuck in time, but in the process, it's also really lyrical and beautiful, and it makes some interesting observations about male and female dynamics and how we raise children differently based on sex. There's a lot going on for a movie that's not really saying much. It's fascinating. Fascinating. It's called Immortal. It's by Ksenia Okapkina, I think is how you see her name. It's really fantastic.
Where did you find that?
It played at a festival somewhere, and somewhere along the line it ended up in my inbox as, here's something by a female filmmaker that you should watch. And I kind of had left it for last minute. I'll get to it eventually. And then it was the last thing that I had on my iPad to watch one day on my way home. And I got home and was still watching it. So it's really, really captivating. It's the kind of thing that doesn't seem like it is much, but then it turns out to be way more than you expect it to be. It was really impressive. And then the other titles that I wanted to mention are, which we already talked about, Souvenir. I also wanted to mention Loose, which is a movie that really kicked my ass when I saw it earlier in the year. Which is way, way, way better than it probably had any right to be, because it kind of plays as the trailer kind of plays it as maybe a thriller, but it's really a drama about this young man who is kind of being misread by everybody around him and society in general, and people making assumptions about your life based on your past, and expectation. It deals with expectation, and it's beautiful, directed by Julius Ona, and some amazing sound design, probably some of the best sound design in a movie that I've seen this year. And that like includes like all the big action movies that I saw this year. Like it plays so beautifully with sound, and a really fantastic performance. The second great performance by Kevin Harris Jr., who had like a year this year. He was also in Waves.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he certainly had a moment. And then the last one I wanted to mention is Lauren Greenfield's The Kingmaker, which is, I think, a Showtime documentary. Lauren Greenfield has made a career for herself as a documentarian of excess, generation wealth. She's made a couple of documentaries about basically people buying things in this culture of consumerism. The Kingmaker is actually a documentary about the, what's her name? The Philippine, Imelda Marcos.
Oh.
I was going to say the shoe
all
lady.
I know about her is the shoes, she's, yeah.
Yeah, so what's fascinating about this is that the Marcoses give her unprecedented access. Like, Imelda Marcos, and it leads me to believe that this family, because it starts as sort of a documentary about Imelda Marcos and her, for lack of a better word, career as a political wife, and then it morphs into how she plays into current day politics in the Philippines and how she is sort of maneuvering her family to get back into power, and it turns out it's more than just her. Part of it is about her, but like, it's just fascinating to me that they give Greenfield, like this amazing access, like they're talking to her through the whole time. And you start to see, like, from very early on, it's clear that these people are not normal. And they're certainly not in touch with reality. And they are living in this, like, weird... It's so crazy. It's just so crazy. They just are so disconnected from the truth and from what's going on even around them. And just the way, like, Greenfield just lets the camera sit for long enough that you capture these... She captures these moments that you're, like... That just gets to the, like, the essence of a person. And it just shows you just how bad these people are. And you're, like... Like, how do you watch this and have any respect for this family at all? And the fact that this movie is out there for people to watch, and, like, it makes them look like tyrants because that's what they are. It's shocking. It's essential viewing. It's super entertaining and really just, it's scary. It's really, really scary. Because most likely they're going to end up in power again. And it's just, it's disheartening. It's disheartening. So yeah, The Kingmaker, so super good. Way better than it has any right to be. Better than the subject matter, that's for sure. And those are my honorable mentions. I have nothing else.
I guess I could tell you about some of the films that were made by men that I liked this year too.
There must be at least one or two.
There's a couple, yeah. Like, so yeah, we already talked about Parasite, which I adored. I think one of the most brilliant pieces of work that I saw this year was The Painted Bird by Vaclav Marhul, the Polish filmmaker. This movie is utterly brutal, but incredibly brilliant. It felt like watching Bresson or Tarkovsky. It didn't feel like a film of our time at all.
I'm still stunning. Shocked that that movie actually, like, gets to that ending, and I don't want to say earns that ending, but it kind of feels that way, because I never in my life imagined that it would end that way and that I would feel okay leaving it, but it's too painful to watch. There's no way.
I don't know if I could ever watch it again, but I think it's absolutely brilliant cinema.
I think for me, my feeling is I don't know if it needed to be that relenting. Like, it just feels like every scene is, like, worse than the last scene. And you're like, okay, well, after three or four bad scenes, you're like, why do I need to watch any more of this? I know where this is going. So by the time you get to the end, you're like, wow, we really ended here? I'm feeling okay with this, but it's like, but it was so hard to get here. I don't know. I don't think it needed to be that difficult. It just feels relentless. It really broke me down. It's too long. It's too painfully long.
It is a very difficult watch, but I think it's very reflective of where we are in the world right now.
Oh God, I hope not. I know things are bad, but oh God, please no, because this is so bad. Like, oh wow.
But maybe that it's good to have that reminder of how bad things can get when you start down this road.
It's true.
To fascism and authoritarianism and extreme racism and ethnocentrism.
Yep.
I don't know. I think it was an absolutely brilliant film. And like I said, like, I would not have guessed that this was a 2019 feature. Like, this honestly
it does feel like it's out of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
And not just because it's black and white. I think it's also just the way that the whole thing unfolds and in different acts and scenes. And yeah,
it does feel like it's classic filmmaking in a way that isn't really made anymore. Mm-hmm. It feels very European. Yeah. For me, it feels a little bit like there was... that other black and white film from like 2 years ago about the war, Cold War, I think it was called, mm-hmm. Cold War, which also felt like a movie that was kind of out of time.
Also Polish. Maybe that's a theme.
I don't know. But it also felt like a movie that could have, like, it was made, it's a contemporary film, but it feels like it could have been made like in the 60s or 70s. Like, it just has this patina to it. This one, I mean, I can appreciate the filmmaking and what he's getting at, but for me, it kind of just broke my spirit a little too much. Just a little too much. One or two scenes too much. That's fair.
I think it is trying to. Yeah. So, yes, yeah, so probably don't go into this if you're already feeling low.
No.
But I did think it was quite brilliant. I also really enjoyed Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I think because I kept thinking about it a lot after it was over. And in large part, that's because of Brad Pitt's Cliff Booth character. Because for me, I couldn't watch him without thinking about Tarantino's relationship with Harvey Weinstein. Mm. And I felt like that relationship between Rick Dalton and Cliff Booth is in some ways similar to, like, I think maybe Quentin was trying to make a point about his relationship with Weinstein, because it's really, really obvious at a certain point that Cliff Booth has murdered his wife. And I think what he's sort of trying to say to us is, like, look how much you like him. You know him, you know this guy killed his wife. You know that he uses violence in every situation that he comes up against, but you like him anyway. And I kind of was wondering if maybe that was Quentin going, yeah, Harvey Weinstein's an asshole, but he was also a good guy to me. And so can you see how I could like him even though he did all these terrible things? And you're doing that with Cliff Booth, and that's kind of what was happening with me with Harvey. And I don't know, I just thought that was interesting.
That's an interesting read into it that I didn't really consider, mostly because I was really disconnected from the picture from the get-go. Like, just something about it just didn't really work for me. And I find that that's the truth. As I get older, the more and more I feel disconnected from Tarantino's films. I don't know what it is. It kind of, in some places, I think for me, it kind of feels like he's flaunting his knowledge or something in a way that makes me feel uneducated filmically. And it kind of gives other men like this opportunity to go, oh yeah, like I get all these references. And I'm kind of like, I feel like
they don't.
Well, but this is it. Like, yeah. But it kind of feels like to them, they're toting this guy who's also like in the in club, and I'm outside of that club, and it makes me feel insecure or belittled somehow. And generally, I don't like the stories that he tells. Like, I don't find, like, Kill Bill was probably the one that I liked the most. Like, Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2 are probably the ones that I liked the most. And probably because they have a female character that I can find some into. But I don't like the way he writes characters. I don't like his male characters. And I don't like the stories he tells. And I generally don't enjoy his alternate history take. I to me, it doesn't do anything. The thing that I liked the most about this movie was actually Leonardo DiCaprio. I thought that he as this like sort of aging actor who is really good at what he does, but he's kind of like
super insecure.
And you know, he's being left behind by Hollywood. Hollywood is moving in a direction and he's not part of that conversation anymore. I thought that was interesting. Like, both as like an aging individual and somebody that feels insecure even within, you know, his profession of choice. And he's obviously good at what he does, and people, like, they tell him he's good, but he doesn't feel that he is. And I really liked his relationship with Brad Pitt's character. I thought that that back and forth sort of camaraderie was really, really interesting. And almost like the peanut gallery that always comes with you, that's always reassuring you that you're doing a good job. Like, I thought that was really interesting, and that sort of brotherly. But like, the story overall, I could fucking care less. I really didn't care.
To be honest, this was his film I was least looking forward to seeing, because I just wasn't sure I wanted to see anything about the Manson family.
And that seems like so far kind of removed to me.
That was the thing. I think when people were talking about this film long before it came out, all they were talking about was, this is Quentin Tarantino's Manson family film.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I really wish he wasn't doing that. And then it's not actually a Manson family movie at all.
No.
That's,
you know, just this little side story.
Yeah. I mean, it's just putting things into context. And I think also, I also think that what I liked about this film was the sort of resurrection of Sharon Tate. Like, I think this film is really reverential to her. And
that
Quentin is kind of putting her back out there and saying, like, hey, stop looking at this woman as a murder victim and start looking at her as an artist who had an incredible amount of potential and who also left some great work behind. Like, you know, she wasn't just Roman's wife. Like, she was a really great actress in her own right. And you should seek out and watch her films. And
I agree.
She shouldn't just be a footnote in the Charlie Manson story.
I agree with that. I can go with that.
So yeah, I really like that.
I just wish that wasn't like just the sort of like side plot to this bigger movie, and it can kind of get lost in there. Like that feels like it needs more attention.
But I think it kind of had to, because we'll never know her. Like nobody knew enough about her to be able to turn this into the Sharon Tate story.
Exactly. So, there wasn't enough material really to create a movie that doesn't turn back into like the Manson story.
Yeah, and I liked that it was sort of ephemeral, and that like, and there was a lot of criticism that Margot Robbie wasn't given enough lines, and I was like, but that wasn't the point. The whole point was that he was sort of presenting her as this almost like a ghostly figure. So of course she couldn't have any lines, because this was all about talking about the sort of conception or idea of Sharon Tate, and trying to change that conception or idea that people have of her from murder victim to actress and artist.
Yeah.
Giving her lines wasn't going to further that at all. So no. I think he got a lot of unfair criticism for being a sexist, for not giving her enough lines, but I don't really think that was the point.
Yeah, no, I could go with that.
And then I also enjoy incredibly over the top gore. So the last like 15 to 20 minutes of this film really worked for me.
Oh yeah. That flamethrower, man. That flamethrower. Apparently a real flamethrower. Who knew? Anything else before we sort of wrap up 2019? I kind of feel like, how comfortable are you with your list? Like, how happy are you like with everything that, I know that there's still stuff left unseen, but how satisfied are you with, year as a whole? Was it a good year in movies?
Yeah.
We had this discussion behind the scenes at Quiet Earth, because I kind of sent out a little note to everybody. I'm like, okay, I'd like to do like a favorite movies of the year. Can you send me a couple of titles? And, the general feeling I got back was, oh, it was a really terrible year for movies, and oh, it was a really good year for movies. I'm kind of like, well, I kind of fall into that it was a really good year for movies, but I always think it's a good year for movies. Like, there's always good material out there if you search it out.
Well, I don't know. Like, I'm not sure how many movies I watched this year. It was probably about 170 films this year. So less than some people. More than probably a lot of people.
Average, yeah.
And I don't know. I always find stuff that's great, that moves me, that I think is interesting, that's experimenting, that's doing new things. So how can you say that a year is bad for film?
That's what I think. I mean, the way I see it, it's like if you thought the year was bad for movies, you didn't watch enough movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Or what are you going by? Like just box office? Like, yeah. I don't know.
I mean, if I had only seen, the however many movies I saw in the theater that were like, big blockbusters, then I would have said it was a disappointing year, because almost none of those really impressed me.
Yeah, none of the Disney properties particularly impressed me either. So Marvel, Star Wars, all of them, they were passable films. They were, moderately entertaining. But hey, that's not the barometer for me.
No, me either. We will link to everything we talked about today. It's going to be a lot. I don't know what else to say. So come on by atcpod.ca. Check out the lists. Send us your lists. Let us know what we missed that you really, really liked. Or is there something on our list that you really, really hated? We want to know why. Let us know. And we'll be back in like 2 weeks' time. Actually, less than that, with the Littlest Hobo Media Spew. So stay tuned. And until next time, we'll see you after the credits.